you know, life isn't sunshine and rainbows. It's going to hit you to the ground. It's going to beat you, you know, to your knees. And the best thing that you can do is to take those hits, pick yourself back up, and brush yourself off. That is what's going to get you through everything.
Today's episode is all about empowerment, creativity, and the freelance journey. Joining us is the brilliant mind behind Blue Cyclops, the renowned brand agency shaking up the industry. Meet Rocky Rourke, the founder and creative director of Blue Cyclops. Make no mistake, Rocky speaks from the heart to deliver wisdom about the trials, tribulations, challenges, and failures that are inherently part of the journey through creative entrepreneurship. Rocky's journey is a testament to the power of freelancing. From his humble beginnings as an illustrator to becoming a leading voice in the industry, Rocky has consistently empowered freelancers and driven client success through creative partnerships. Sit back and enjoy this insightful journey through Rocky's career, where he achieved six-figure incomes and became an outspoken advocate for freelance designers.
Rocky, it's so great to have you today. You are a design powerhouse. You have a rich background in graphic design, branding. You have Instagram, YouTube following where you talk about the business of design. You share your design process. Clearly, you've been at this for a while and really have some strong opinions and a lot of skills around the field of design. Can you back us up a little bit and tell us where this journey started for you and how you got there and how you sort of navigated that early terrain to where you got today?
Sure, I can definitely do that. So I'm only 33 years old. However, I've been in design for 20 years. 20 years as of this year, so which is crazy to think. I first got into it in high school. I blindly signed up for a graphic arts class. Someone told me, oh, this is video game design. You know, like I was like, oh, cool. I'm going to be able to create video games. I love this. Great. Show up for the first class and all I see is Macintosh computers and printing equipment, screen printing, all that. I'm like, this does not look like video game design to me. I ended up taking that class a total of 8 times over 4 years.
Wow.
It's crazy. I think from what I heard from my teacher before he retired, I was the only student and only student to do it up to that point and the only student to do it after that point. In fact, he had to create a whole curriculum just for the last 2 classes, just for me. But from there, when I was about, I think, 16 or 17, I ended up getting a job at a printing company, a local printing company, where I was the lead artist, where I did all of the designs, learned how to do screen printing, learned how to run a business and everything. And from there, basically since probably age 15, I was also freelancing, doing design work, illustration work, creating things for anything from mixtape covers for wannabe rappers to creating graduation invitations and everything like that. I ended up from high school going on to university where I took design, found out very quickly I was ahead of everybody else in the program. And spent my extra time basically learning as much as I can, reaching out to hundreds of artists and designers, started doing more freelancing during that time, ended up being the first illustrator for a game called Cards Against Humanity, which everybody has heard of.
Oh, yep. Wow. Yep.
There's definitely a story there.
Oh, we've got a few stories playing the game.
So. Oh, I bet. I still have I have one of the first runs of Cards Against Humanity somewhere in this house. From there, when I graduated, I had zero opportunities. I had no idea what I was going to do. And ended up making connections online, going to conferences, and got a job as a branding designer. A year later, was fired from that job and moved to California, where I lived for 8 years. Got the job as a UI UX designer. So you kind of like ping ponging beyond different industries. Was there for 2 years before I decided to strike out on my own and do my own thing. Yeah, it's been, I think, what, 8 years now of Blue Cyclops, my design studio, and here we are now.
Awesome. So tell us more about Blue Cyclops, because I know for anybody listening, it's BlueCyclopsDesignCo.com, correct?
It's BlueCyclops.co, yeah.
BlueCyclops.co. If you go to the About page, your team has expanded quite significantly outside of just you. So what was that like in terms of sort of exponentiating yourself into the growth of Blue Cyclops? And you know, what were some of the key elements that helped shape that next evolution of Rocky's design journey?
Yeah, so from 2016 to 2021, basically it was just me. I would bring on freelancers from time to time to collaborate on projects. If there was something that either I didn't have the bandwidth for, or if it was something that I felt like someone else could do a better job, I would bring them on to projects. But for the most part, it was a shop of one. It was, you know, I still call it a studio. I always use the Royal We, you know, which a lot of freelancers do, which there's nothing wrong with that. But for many years it was just me. And what happened was I ended up getting burnt out during the pandemic. During 2020, I was taking on every single project that was coming my way, every single one. So we're talking at the height of it, juggling 9 projects at once, just myself.
Wow.
Yeah, it got to the point where I was so burnt out. I ended up, moving Blue Cyclops to part-time and going working for a couple startups, first as a lead designer to help grow a design and marketing team, and then an art director at a Bitcoin company. And when I finally went back to Blue Cyclops full-time, I was like, I can't do this just on my own. It's, you know, not sustainable. There's no way to grow if it's just myself, because there's only so many, you know, hours in the day. Unfortunately, I can't clone myself, which I look forward to that technology. And so last summer, I think it was, or actually last spring, I started, you know, putting my feelers out, looking for, you know, people to bring on. At first, it was just to help with my own podcast, The Design Break. Create assets for that, so that way I could free up some of my time there, and brought on a designer named Joel Anderson, amazing branding designer and illustrator, and he was the first one I brought on. Still, like, everybody who's part of the team are freelancers. That way they have their own freelance business. You know, I help them where I can, you know, give them ideas on how they can grow it. But that way everybody has a bit of freedom, because I don't want everybody to be tied down and, you know, think of working, you know, with Blue Cyclops as a 9-to-5. You know, I want them to have fun with it, you know, and be able to still have that full freedom that we all enjoy. But from there, we brought on another 2 designers. My wife, after our son was born, she ended up deciding to come in-house and start working as now the chief of staff for Blue Cyclops. Still working on training her. She calls herself a glorified secretary. But she's working on it. We're trying to get, you know, things ramped up on her side there. And then we have like a few other freelancers who we're hoping to bring on more full time as we progress and everything. But it's definitely been easy and difficult at the same time. I'm very big on networking, so I'm always out there, as you mentioned, Simon, about, you know, me on social media and everything. Basically what I did was I just reached out to my network and was like, hey, I'm looking for people, you know, does anybody know of anybody, or does anybody want to like send their portfolio? I did no actual job listings anywhere. It was all through Twitter and LinkedIn. And so that's basically how we grew it to where we're at right now. I think we're at like maybe 7 to 9 people, I think, last time I checked, so.
We'd like to take a moment to remind you that Play In Conversations is brought to you by Play & Co. If you want to explore more about design opportunities, discover new insights, or connect with Play & Co. for a design project, be sure to visit playandco.com.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a couple of thoughts here, and they're not yet questions, but what I first want to say is the parallels between your journey and our, there's a lot of overlap. I think we started our company, not in 2016, 2015, Karen and I, we started Plan Co. in Hollywood in 2015, and then we had a baby girl like the following year, so it was baptism by fire for us. So what you're talking about with COVID and managing projects and all of the other things that life throws your way resonates strongly with us. And it's nice to hear a couple of things. It's nice to hear about the consideration when you're building out your creative team, like the thinking we took a similar approach when we, when Planco was born, you know, it was only Brendan and Karen doing everything. Yeah. But, you know, when we had three or four extra projects, we relied on our network, mm-hmm. Designers that we knew in the past, who we called on, who delivered and did some great work for us. One of them ended up being our first hire, and then we treaded water with the three of us for probably up until Q3 last year, and then we just brought on Simon full time and a couple of other designers too, and we're looking to expand a bit further. So it's definitely a journey, the creator's journey. And I put one thing for me. It'd be interesting to hear your thoughts on, there's a couple of things, but the first one is going from creative doer to creative director, potentially. Mm-hmm. So knowing that you have 7 to 9 people and you're managing hopefully a broader body of work. How do you find, do you still get to dig deep into projects as well as maybe just directing others? And how do you choose and how do you balance that?
Yeah, that was one of the harder parts for sure, was being able to delegate, because I'm a perfectionist. I'll admit that. I also work very fast. And so it took me forever. In fact, I just started getting better about this about maybe 2 months ago, about not jumping in and making the fixes myself. Cause some of my designers, they would be like, I could have swore something was different about that design. Like did I sleep design or something? I was like, no, I actually went in and I made a couple little corrections here and there. But now I actually, you know, I give more control to the designers, where I'm now, you know, delegating, where I'm adding comments in there. Once in a while, I'll change like a little color or something like that. But it was definitely difficult at the beginning to give up that control. Now it's where I'm able to focus more on business growth, client management, strategy, those types of areas. Mm. And so I would say I still probably touch about 20% of the design. And especially when it's internal work, it's probably a bit more. But luckily I've got, you know, a solid team that I can rely on, that I can fall back on with projects and everything. And yeah, as we continue to get more work in, I'm sure we're going to be growing continuously.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and what I like about talking about the shared experience thing, my observations and Karen's, I'm sure, as well, has been similar to yours, in that you relinquishing control it's not easy, not only from an emotional perspective, but also from a how you compute and give feedback and how your process, because it is still a creative process, right? To direct people and get the desired results. That's the first thing. But I think it's only been probably in the last half year and maybe a little longer, and Karen can speak to this too, but really understanding that when you do have a good team around you, and you don't have to hold the pencil, and they start to drive work and present you with a good foundation from which you can
build on,
guide. Then, to your point about thinking about business growth and broadening your influence of your company or your personal brand, gets a lot more you can think about that more. And that's a job in and of itself that you don't think about when you start freelancing, because you're just like, oh, I'll just focus
get
on the
good
work.
Job done. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm going to follow that up, Rocky, by saying, like, it's so admirable how frequently you post with, like, thought leadership, you know, across all the different platforms, you know.
Yeah, how do you do that?
Yeah, like
is there like an engine?
How many hours do you have in a day?
Oh, man. I'll be honest with you. There's a lot of times where I'm not just sitting at my computer doing that. It's like I'll carve out time. I'll be sitting in my chair upstairs, you know, watching, you know, a show with my wife and everything. Or, you know, when I'm out running errands, I'll stop and just like sit in the truck for a little bit and just like, okay, let's see, is there anything I need to do? I also use schedulers as well. So I think like one of the tools that I use, I currently have, I think 15 to 16 tweets scheduled out. And right. Like that's not going to be like all of my tweets that I put out over the next like couple of weeks, but that's, you know, specifically things I was like, oh, here's some good ones that I should put out. Here's some like engagement style tweets, yeah. Like just to get the community going and everything like that. But yeah, it's the biggest thing with putting out content across different social channels comes down to batching, you know, not just going and trying to do it, you know, oh, I'm going to put out two Twitter posts today. Oh, I'm going to put out a LinkedIn post. I'm going to get some Instagram stuff out there. Instead, you know, actually going and batching things out, planning things out, and throwing in some organic stuff as you're going through. And that's, you know, especially in the last couple of weeks, I've been doing that a lot more, and I've been seeing a lot of growth, especially over Twitter, LinkedIn, and my own newsletter sign up as well.
So you're one of these people that still calls it Twitter?
Yep. I will never call it anything but Twitter. I'll be honest. I do not like Elon Musk.
I think most people.
Hey, you're in a safe place here.
Yeah. Most people probably still call it Twitter. Just
I know. I was like, thinking that.
It's just by habit, I think. It's just so such an established brand. And then changing to X kind of, I don't know. People just so used to something.
Yeah, I will always call it Twitter. I met Elon Musk back in like 2016, 2017, very briefly at some sort of event in San Francisco. And I did not like him as soon as I met him. I used to be like, I had his book. Like, I was like so enamored by him. Then when you meet him in person, you just get completely disillusioned by who he actually is.
Anything that you could air publicly, or you want to keep it at that?
I'll keep it at that. Just in case. I don't want to get banned from Twitter.
Yeah, I don't want to be blacklisted either, so
right.
We'll save it for beers in Atlanta someday. But I think getting back on the social platform and the social building, I think it was fascinating for us to hear a little bit about the mechanics around how you approach delivering the message. So you spoke about the schedulers and batching, and even just, I think it's nice for people to hear, particularly a lot of young designers that I hope this is resonating with, who are thinking about going down a creative path like yours, that you don't stop thinking as a creative. So you could be on the sofa watching TV, or you could be out and about, and I do this all the time too. I have like just notes on my phone, like lists of notes. And we have a Slack channel. So I'm harassing Simon when it's probably 3 a.m. in New York. he gets a little nudge to make sure he's still alive. But I think to Simon's point, you have an audience, you have a big audience, a relatively big audience. And so there's something in Rocky Rourke and your culture building that is resonating with people. Can you maybe speak a little bit to what you think that could be? Like, why do people, I mean, I know there's the mechanisms, there's like the whole strategy for acquiring an audience, but what is it about your message that people are really responding to? Do you consider yourself an educator, an evangelist?
I would say definitely an educator, kind of. Like, I'll never be a professor. I have no drive to ever be a professor. You know, but I've coached and mentored many designers over the years, and I look at it as giving back. When I was a young designer, when I was in college, you know, I mentioned I, you know, reached out to hundreds of designers and artists, and I asked them questions, and there was probably a handful of them that actually like continued to communicate with me, not just over like one or two emails, but like over dozens and dozens of emails. And I look at it as me paying it forward, me giving it back to the community. And so it's why I'm also always an open book. You know, if somebody asks me, you know, a question, I, you know, tell them the truth. You know, I care to help people, because, you know, I know that there's a lot of people out there, they put things behind a paid wall and they don't want to, you know, just share the secret sauce. Now, does that mean I'm not going to eventually put things behind a paid wall? I plan to. I'm actually working on a program, like a coaching program course stuff right now. However, I'm going to give as much information as possible free to people, you know. And that's just because I don't feel like, you know, knowledge should be, you know, it should cost, you know, a ton of money or anything like that. Now, I've paid tons of money for courses and for right now I'm in a coaching program that's helping me out, especially like teaching me new things about, you know, social and, you know, expanding my own business and things like that. But, you know, especially for younger designers, for those who are like just getting into freelancing, or worse, they, you know, find themselves being laid off and they're trying to get into freelancing, you know, I want to help those people because I've been there. I've been fired. I've been laid off. You know, I've been without freelance work. And so I know exactly where they're coming from. And so I just want to, you know, lend that helping hand, so to speak.
Where do you come down on platforms like Fiverr and freelancer.com and that kind of a thing?
I've always hated them. I mean, for one, and this even goes with like Dribbble too, right? Because Dribbble's kind of become that, where I used to be a huge Dribbble supporter. I've been on the platform since 2013. And now I just like I'm trying to give it the benefit of the doubt, but I feel like it's gotten just to the same point. Fiverr, Upwork, 99 Designs. I feel like with, for a lot of us, you know, for agencies, for freelancers, the clients who are going to hire people on there were never going to hire you to begin with.
Yeah.
You know, they don't value design. Yeah. They value the quick turnaround time, the cheap, but they don't value the quality. So, you know, if somebody, you know, if you're going through a sales process and then all of a sudden the person comes back and says, oh, sorry, like I actually found someone to do it cheaper. Don't fret. Don't get upset, because guess what? They never were going to hire. They were tire kickers. They were never going to hire you to begin with.
They become more of a headache.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And it ends up costing you 10 times more. Yeah. So, yeah.
$1,000 project that lasts like 3 months.
Yeah. Oh God. Been there many times.
Yeah.
You know, when you were walking through that, I think that's an excellent point, and it brings up the question or the observation or the hypothesis, and I want your expert opinion on this. What you could argue is that those platforms commoditize design. Mm-hmm. So to your point, it's about the lowest price, fastest turnaround, quick fix, band-aid on a leaky hose kind of solution. But what I think, you being an educator and building this online presence and giving a warts and all view of the industry and like being a voice of truth, one of the things that I can imagine your messages would be is invest in your own brand, right? As a freelancer, invest in your own PR, your own social platforms, getting great concept studies under your belt, elevating your perceived value and quality. Because I think I was saying this right before we got on the call to Karen. I was like, you know, we all grow together. As creatives, and like stand-up comedians, I think was the example we used before, you know. So it's just an observation, but.
Yeah, I think honestly, all freelancers, all designers, they should work on building their own brand. I will say this, that building your own brand and building a strong brand actually can be detrimental. I honestly feel that it's one of the reasons I got fired from my second job out of college. Because my personal brand had gotten so big that it outshined this agency I was at.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, where people would go to conferences that from my my agency I worked at, and they would mention where they worked. And the first thing that they would hear was, oh, you work with Rocky. Or worse, you work for Rocky. That would be even that'd be even worse. And the founder of the agency was at a conference, and they saw the name on his tag from this is I'm hearing this secondhand, but and they were like, oh, yeah, Rocky works there, doesn't he? And he was like, wait, what? He you know, believed that the brand for the agency was so big, and then for one person to outshine it, he didn't like that. So
that's a shame.
Yeah,
well, that's compliments to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. You, well, yeah, you outgrew the pond.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, I feel like going back to the 99 Designs, Upwork and everything like that, I think for younger designers, younger freelancers, I think it's okay. You know, especially also for the freelancers who aren't necessarily in the United States, who might be in third world countries, those platforms give you a possibility to make income.
Yeah.
For people who are more seasoned professionals, people who are, you know, in the United States, in Europe, in Australia, going on those platforms probably won't be the best place to go. You know, it's better to have more organic, more networking and everything like that.
As a thought leader in the design space, you know, the design field is continuously evolving. You know, obviously we have AI, we have Midjourney, we have ChatGPT going on.
Here it comes.
So how do you keep yourself and your team updated with some of these latest trends and technologies? And where do you see this next evolution of design going, both, you know, in the world at large as well as in your own practice as somebody who started literally in a print shop screen printing?
So I'll be 100% honest. I love AI. I am one of those people who I embrace it because, for one thing, I look at it for what it is. AI is a tool. AI is not going to replace designers. It's not going to replace illustrators, thought leaders, strategists, whatever you want to call us, right? You know, it's not going to replace us. It's a tool. It's just like Illustrator. It's just like Figma. That's what it is. You know, and again, it's that same argument about the clients who would use Upwork and 99 Designs, Fiverr, and all that stuff. They never were going to be your clients anyway. They're looking for the cheap thing. They're not looking for someone who's going to bring value. They're not looking for value. They're looking for short-term gains, and it's just going to cause bigger design debt later on if they just rely on that. Yeah. You know, I use ChatGPT. I use Midjourney. You know, I have two major retainer clients that we work with, and both of them, we use Midjourney for some of their stuff. You know, we've used it for crafting stock photography or stock people. You know, if we want a specific look for the person, we can instantly customize it versus having to spend hours upon hours looking at stock photography and or, you know, trying to recreate something with an actual photograph. So I personally love it. I've been using Midjourney for probably a year and a half now, same time for ChatGPT. And I feel like as long as we look at it for what it is as a tool, that's how we're going to, you know, make it through this. And for the people out there, because I know that there's a lot of artists and illustrators out there who are up in arms about AI, they're up in arms against DALL-E and Midjourney. They're like, oh, well, it just, you know, scanned our work and, you know, it's stealing our stuff. It's stealing what makes us special and everything like that. What do you think that, you know, the design students do, right? when we were students, what did we do? We literally looked at what other people did. We copied it. We developed our own styles, and that's basically what it's doing. The only thing that, you know, has you upset about is the fact that it's a computer doing it versus an actual human being. So that's my personal opinion on it.
Yeah. You know, when you were speaking, there were two things that came to my mind. One I totally blanked on, but the second one was the getting back to your point about the guys that were never going to hire you in the first place. I think some of the work that we are doing is on a brand platform level. So to your point about AI, it's a tool that plugs into a broader system of brand elements that create an identity, right? Yeah. And you can't ask a computer to do that. And you can't ask anyone in the world to do that, no matter where they're living, to create a brand system and help you to roll that out for bargain basement prices. Something's got to give. So the investment, and I think that the investment really comes down to the client. And the other, Simon, I am going off the tech axis for a second, but I think what I'm trying to contextualize here is that the tech is, to get back to Rocky's point, the tech is a tool. It's a means to an end. And the end that we're trying to create is value by design, which is identity systems or an identity for clients. And so to your point, Rocky, like if there are clients that are maybe mid-tier designs that just can't afford hiring models, the time and photography budgets and things like that.
Also, but like sort of going out shooting in random locations, like the cost of that too. So using those tools to generate those visual assets actually can save time and get some closer and save time and money.
So I think to your point, when done right, it's going to elevate the industry. As long as you, as a creative, the audience, I mean, understand the value of the tool and how to apply it. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think there was a recent tweet I saw from Neil Patel where he kind of talks about this, where within like the first 5 months of us having AI generated content and human written content, you know, being published on the web, you know, human written content generated 5.44x more traffic, you know, and I think that's because we can see that as human beings. We can spot what's been made by us versus what's been made by a computer. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, you know, when you have a giant ad campaign where it's going to be everywhere from magazines to the web to trailers on TV or on streaming services and things like that, in those situations, you want to have real photography. You want to have something that has been dialed in versus if you're throwing up social ads, you know, that's a whole different thing where you can generate someone, you can generate, you know, objects and things like that in there. And that's to be expected because that's a lower commitment design element, right? Versus a larger magazine ad. Your company is already spending hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars on that campaign. They're going to want the best. And sometimes AI generated is not going to be considered the best. Most times it's not going to be considered the best.
Excellent so point.
Something, yeah, to consider.
Mm-hmm. And perspective too for creatives. So getting back to freelancers getting off the ground and trying to build their brand, you might think that you're expensive. You might think that 10 grand for a logo seems like no one will pay for that. But to your point, if this logo is the foundation or the anchor of a brand that's going to be multinational, it's pennies. I think there was a whole discussion around, there was a whole debate around how much BP paid. Forgive me, I know they're a petroleum brand, but I think it's the most expensive logo design ever made. And I think it was in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And it was just a tweak on the previous logo.
But the big picture with that was, is it wasn't just the logo, right? It was all these touch points. And that's the one thing people don't consider is they think, oh, wow, they paid, what was it, like 24, 25 million or some obscene amount of money for that. And they're like, they paid that much for a logo. No, they paid that much for the entire ecosystem of the brand, including going down into the actual gas stations, the trucks, even the paper cups for coffee and things like that. If you compare, my favorite example is always comparing the Nike logo to the Next logo, the Steve Jobs Next logo, right?
Yeah.
Where, if I remember correctly, I think the student got paid $50 to $75 for the Nike logo. And look at where that is today, right?
Yeah.
It's still there. It's still everywhere. I'm sure that student probably still is kicking themselves every time they see somebody walk down the street with a Nike logo on their shoes. Then you look at the Next logo, right? Was it Paul Rand or Saul Bass? I can't remember who did it. I think it was Paul Rand.
One of them, yeah.
Yeah.
I vaguely remember the story.
Yeah.
Keep going.
He charged, I believe, $1 million to Steve Jobs for that logo. He did not allow him any options. He did not allow him any feedback. He's like, you pay me $1 million and I'm going to give you this logo. And that's it. And that's what he did, right? Now, the Next logo, Next doesn't even exist. It's not even around, right? Mm. Steve Jobs paid $1 million because Paul Rand's brand was so strong, because he worked with all these companies, IBM, ABC, all these different companies, right? Versus this student who never probably designed anything for anyone before, creates a logo, gets paid 50 bucks, 75 bucks, and that logo is still around to this day, probably since I think the 70s, right? 80s, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Paul Rand. I just checked.
Paul Rand. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. With Paul Rand did the Next. And as far as the Nike logo went, her name was Carolyn Davidson. Yeah. She designed the logo in 1971. I believe she was a graphic design student at Portland State University. She spent 17 and a half hours designing it for $35. For $35.
I gave her a benefit of a doubt.
Right. But later in the 90s, I believe it was, Phil Knight gave her a gold ring with the swoosh on it, as well as, I think, a very healthy amount of Nike shares, which are now worth in the millions of dollars. Okay. So they made up for it at least.
Yeah.
But.
But in that first, like in the initial part of it, right? $35 for the logo versus $1 million, right?
Yeah,
later on, and I'm sure he probably also had pressure from people once that story came out, because I think it came out in the 90s. Like, they talked about it and everything, and people were probably in an uproar, and they're like, here, let's do this. This will be a cheap fix for us, for our PR that we went back and gave her, the stuff. So.
Yeah,
totally. But yeah, the $35, yeah, that's such a great story. And I'm from Portland, Oregon myself, even though I live in New York now. So any of that Nike history stuff really, really resonates with me. But since we're talking about this brand angle, Rocky, and we're talking about design systems and platformization, whether it's AI or it's getting under the hood in Illustrator or Figma, I think one of the common denominators there is just sort of having a strong philosophy behind a branding strategy, as well as really being able to inject that storytelling element across all those assets. And you and your work at Blue Cyclops, you've done a ton of brand work. Mm-hmm. So what's your approach to leaning into that client and figuring out what that story is, regardless of the tool you use, like what's the Blue, since Blue Cyclops has such a strong branding angle, without divulging into secrets, how do you approach that is different from like an AI tool, for example?
Well, probably one of the biggest things that we do is we have multiple conversations with the client from before we've even closed on them. We learn as much as we can We, of course, have a branding questionnaire where they fill out a ton of information. And sometimes I'll even come back, and if they haven't filled in enough information, where they give like one word responses, I'm like, no, go back, take your time with it. Even if it takes you a whole weekend or something like that, take your time and refill this out. The more information, the better. And in fact, it now has in the questionnaire under each single question, more information. If you think you've written enough, write some more. But it comes down to really just like talking, you know, to the client. A lot of creatives, a lot of agencies, they will get very systematic and very sterile. They'll act like they are wearing white lab coats when they're talking to their clients. And I don't like being that way. I want my clients to see me as a partner, as like a friend, where it's like, okay, you know, tell me pain points. Like, what's really going on? Like, why do you really need to go through this rebranding? You know, where does it stem from? Does it stem from just someone said that they don't like your logo? Or is it something where you guys are losing, you know, $1 million a month or something like that, you know, because you don't have the proper brand awareness, you know? So I dig really deep into that. And that part of the process is still 100% me. You know, I handle all of that type of stuff. And I learned a lot early on about that from my first job when I worked as a branding designer. Most of my job was production design. Like, we're talking churning out 25 to 100 logos a week, basically. You know, just exploration upon exploration upon exploration, to the point I got burnt out from it. But the moments where I got to see and interact with our brand strategist, and seeing like how my boss interacted with clients, the questions that they asked and everything, those were the things that taught me so much. And then when I went on to work at the UI UX agency, even though like we did I led a couple of branding projects while we were there. However, everything else was about strategy and about UI, UX, web design, you know, product design, which for product designers, all the power to you, because that stuff bores the crap out of me, I'll be honest with you. But just seeing that strategy and learning all I could about that side of things, delving into marketing and everything, it taught me so much. And so I think a lot of branding shops, they focus specifically on the process of creating a visual brand identity, but they don't think about the hardest part, which is the after. You know, a lot of branding shops, they hand off at the end a style guide, brand guidelines, some files, and that's it. And they basically say, you know, here you go. You know, thanks so much for your help. Let us know if you need anything down the line. But they don't think about the brand application. They don't think about the brand expansion. When I worked during the time where I worked in house at a SaaS company, they had just gone through a rebrand before they hired me, and they brought in, you know, they worked with a company out of England. I'm not going to say who they are, but they, you know, they did a great job. The brand was really nice. It was really cutting edge. It was definitely trendy. That's the one negative part that I'll say to that. But the biggest problem was, is they never considered, okay, what happens after we give them the brand? And so I ended up having to spend 6 months expanding the brand and making it to where they could utilize it across all of their different departments and across all of their multiple marketing campaigns, because they went through probably about 3 or 4 marketing campaigns a month at that company. Wow. And so there was a lot that had to be done. And that was something that they never considered when they were working on building the brand out.
That was an excellent point, by the way. And I've got a couple of things to summarize. First one is, ask more questions, get more answers.
Yep.
The second point is, you just spoke to, again, the value of the experience as opposed to outsourcing design through a platform like Fiverr or Upwork. And for those listening, I hope it's not a founder of Fiverr or Upwork, because they're going to hate on me on this podcast. But that's really...
Well, that's a very different business model.
Yeah.
So you can't compare. That's the thing.
Thank you, Karen. Yeah. Just, excellent point.
with what people are hiring. Yeah, with playing Switzerland. On like Fiverr and Upwork, they're hiring specifically for a logo design. That's really what they're going for. Yeah, versus a full visual brand identity. That is so much more. Sometimes even I forget what all needs to actually go into it.
But also the point about the rollout, like it's true. Unless one of those companies have someone like you that was working in-house, it would just probably not be as well executed externally to the public that they hope. And I think that's the problem where maybe sometimes it gets a little lost and maybe clients get frustrated because they get this amazing brand package, but then they're like, okay, what do I do with it? And it can kind of get not translated.
Here's a good thought that Karen just provoked in me. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Johnny Ive, the ex-head of, I'm glad you are. Industrial designer. I didn't know how far you went into that, but he, and I don't think he's the only one that said this, so forgive me if I'm misattributing the quote, but he said that design is 10% inspiration, 90% perspiration. Mm-hmm. And to Karen's point, it's one thing to hand over a deck, but to translate that into value for the brand really takes work, right? And planning and making sure that you're managing that brand rollout through all the touch points. And if you don't have a competency in-house, you need to rely on the exterior team to really help that in an enduring relationship. So I know you mentioned you've got two big retainer-based clients, and it's funny, we hadn't really serviced a model like that until recently, but we have two quite big clients that do something similar. Mm-hmm. And there's been an enduring debate, at least in industrial design over the past decade, two decades, around, do we have in-house? Do we have consultants? And to be honest, it really depends on the company. It depends on their structure, their size, their ability to invest in a full-time team, the quality of people they can get to fill that role, depending on how niche their market is and their industry.
Also their business strategy.
And I think that there's value on both sides of the fence. So I just wanted to call that out and see if you had any thoughts on it.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, we work with mostly brand and marketing teams. That's like our main target, is to work directly with those type of departments. And almost every single one, they all have the same problems, which is not enough creative resources, meaning like they don't have enough people to fulfill their needs. They have slow turnaround times for any type of creative, right? You know, they need it yesterday and they get it 2 weeks from now. And they lack the cohesion across their brand. You know, if you go into a lot of these tech companies, unless they're, you know, spending millions of dollars on design, a lot of them, when you look across their different, you know, teams, product team, brand, marketing, sales, everything is just up in the air. You know, salespeople could still be using Microsoft Art, you know, the different like 3D graphics and everything. I just saw that recently, so that's the reason why that came up. But they're missing
Sorel Draw. Do you remember that one?
I never used it. I was very lucky. I started in Photoshop 8 and Illustrator CS.
Oh yeah, you're too young.
Younger. Yeah. Yeah.
So like I've started that at that point, but I'm so glad I never had to learn Corel.
That was the poor man's Illustrator.
Yeah, yeah.
We had to. Karen and I both
just pirated internships
when we were up and coming.
Oh. Yeah, but these companies, you know, they run into these issues. And so, going after what you were just talking about of internal versus external, I feel like external is better in many cases, and it comes down to one specific thing, which is the outsider perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yay, preach. That's what we tell everyone.
Exactly.
Because, and the reason for that, sorry, I don't know. I'll let you finish that thought.
Well, the biggest thing is that everybody's drinking the Kool-Aid internally. Mm-hmm. Everybody has been so ingrained in the day to day. And, you know, they're like, we're going to make the best product in the world. Yeah. And in reality, they're ranked number 29 or lower, right? And so, you know, by having, you know, an external partner, by hiring an agency, or even just hiring a completely external design team, which is something we're trying to work on right now, is, you know, the best thing for that outsider perspective. You know, because now instead of everybody's so ingrained, they're at, you know, ground level, we're at, you know, a 30,000 foot view, you know, looking down, and we're able to give them perspectives. When I was hired at the Bitcoin company, I had very little knowledge of of Bitcoin. And it was the one thing that was holding them back at first from hiring me. And it came down to talking about that, about the outsider's perspective, that ended up, you know, convincing them. And even though I was eventually laid off from the company, they then hired me a week later as a consultant. And I've been working with them now for almost 2 years now. So outside perspective wins every time, in my opinion.
That's not uncommon, by the way, too. Sorry, Simon. That's not uncommon for people to get laid off and then get brought back as contractors, creative contractors, and have a more enduring relationship.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was gonna double down on your point, Rocky. I went in a previous agency life. I was working with a Fortune 100 company. I'm not going to name names. And we worked with multiple departments within this company, which is known for being very design and creative forward. And we came to learn that their entire marketing team, just the logo itself, it was they have a very unique brand color. It was five different hex codes across five different departments.
Only five? We have a client right now. They have 12 different hex codes for one color, seven for another. God. Like it.
Oh my God.
Color
does my head in, especially when I get in, not so much in product, but in brand. Oh my God. Like CMYKs to Pantones to bloody hex to whatever else you've got to figure out. Forget it.
Right. Yeah, to your point, Rocky, only five. But yeah, for a company this size that's known for design and creativity, it was quite a shocker. And it wasn't until they had that outsider perspective where all of it just sort of consolidated into an updated style guide that never would have happened internally. Which brings me to my next question, you know, since that's sort of on the commercial side of things, a lot of the stuff you do is not only, you know, in helping build these design systems and platformization of brand, but you also have this very artistic, illustrative style. So how do you balance that that sort of free-flowing artistic creativity with that commercial aspect to the work?
So definitely going back years, because I believe I mentioned this, maybe I didn't mention this, but Blue Cyclops originally was opened as a illustration studio. That's all we did was just illustration work. And that was because I worked in branding, I worked in UI, UX, web design, and everything like that. But my passion for years was illustration. All of my freelance work that I did on the side was always illustration work. And so from 2016 to 2018, 2019, we were just an illustration shop doing, you know, still bringing in six figures every year from illustration. And the biggest thing that I realized, though, was that I actually wanted to grow my business, you know, and you can only make so much money as a solo designer doing illustration work. So I had to expand from there. For me, it comes down to that same thing, you know, when I worked full time, where I had my work, which was not very illustrative. It was very analytical. It was very, you know, corporate. And then I have my freelance work, which was more illustrative. And I think that's what it comes down to, is having that balance where we don't always take on a ton of illustration work anymore. But when we do take it on, that's the way that we kind of like stretch our legs creatively. And then we also do side projects. We're actually working on one right now. The whole team is working on it in downtime. You know, whenever we're waiting on feedback from clients, we're waiting on files or anything like that. And, you know, this project, the whole thing is, number one, to have a new case study in the mix, because for me, client work does not bring in more client work. It's always the personal projects, the side projects just because you're so much more passionate. Let's be honest. You're so much more passionate about your own work than you are going to be with a client work. Unfortunately, that's the case. And so we're currently working on something for that. But also, of course, you know, it's something to just like make the team happy, like have something that they're proud of, that where we are the clients, so to speak. And so by doing that, by, you know, splitting up, you know, the type of work that we have coming in and also doing these side projects, we're able to keep that creativity going, even if, you know, sometimes, well, a lot of times the work isn't always creative. It's more, you know, corporate. It's more, you know, creating 50 ads, you know, with very tight constraints, or can I see that ad with these five different titles on it? So, you know, those aren't going to be very creative. Those are, you know, pure production type work.
Yeah. You said, I realized that I wanted to grow. And this is another kind of fork in the road moment for a lot of creatives, where some decide to stay small and be freelancers and earn a comfortable income, and some say, fuck it, I'm going big time. And the it's a different psychology, and I'm curious to know what your motivation is for growth. We have ours, but everyone is different. Yeah, that's the first question.
So basically, growing up, I was poor, like poor single parent household, struggled quite a bit. I've been working since probably age 8, you know, I had my own lawn care business from the age of 8 to 19. Wow. I sold bootleg copies of stuff. I'm not going to say what any of it is, but I sold bootleg copies of different things. I set up my own print shop in the school graphic arts class, where I was printing off business cards, invitations, and everything like that without the teachers knowing it. You know, I basically had, you know, was hustling hard trying to make money and everything. And so that's always been my biggest drive is hustle. Nowadays I'm like, I don't like hustle culture as much because it's become very toxic. But for me, I looked at it this way. I never want to be in that situation again where in my situation, you know, I was worried if the landlord was going to evict us, right? Or if we were going to be able to, you know, have food for the next couple of days. And so that has always given me that drive. And so in that moment, I was like, okay, there could be another recession that hits. You know, something could happen, and eventually it did, right? COVID happened right after I made that decision. And so because I decided to diversify, only about maybe 20% of the work that I did in 2020 was illustration. The rest was branding. There was a little bit of web design, graphic design in there and everything. And if I wouldn't have done that, I never would have made nearly as much money as I did. And 2020 was my best year to date because of
that. Surprising. Yeah, we were quite similar.
We were really busy in those COVID, initial COVID years. Like, it's crazy what a pandemic can do to... Yeah.
Pandemics are good for business.
Industry.
I'll be honest, I lost $40,000 in work in 2 weeks. Like,
it's crazy.
Lockdown happens and all of these requests got pulled. Like, everybody started tightening purse strings.
Yeah.
And so that just had me go and take on every single project. And because I took on every project, you know, we made quite a bit of money that year. Mm. So
I guess the final thought is, what advice might you have for new graphic designers entering the field, or design entrepreneurs that want to chart out with their own design agency?
You're going to fail more times than you're going to succeed. That's just the truth of it. If I, you know, would be able to flip the script and have more successes than I did the failures, oh my God, I would be, you know, 7-8 figures right now. You know, I would be talking to you from probably like a vacation home in some, you know, remote, you know, island or something like that. But no, you're going to have these horrible times. And that's just a part of the game. You're going to, you know, regret things. You're going to second guess yourself. The biggest thing that I always tell myself is, I don't really have regrets. everything that I have done between the time that I was a little kid to the time I am today got me to this point. And I look at this point now and I'm like, I've got it pretty good right now, you know? And I look at other points before now and I'm like, I've got it pretty good. You know, I've got a roof over my head. I've got some income coming in and everything. And so by not having regrets and not focusing on why, you know, why you're not where you want to be, that's one of the biggest things. Going off of, you know, what everybody always thinks of when they hear my name, you know, Rocky Balboa, you know, go back and watch that famous quote that he says to his son in the Rocky Balboa movie, Rocky VI. I think that would be the number of it. And, you know, he basically says, life isn't sunshine and rainbows. It's going to hit you to the ground. It's going to beat you, you know, to your knees. And the best thing that you can do is to take those hits, pick yourself back up and brush yourself off. That is what's going to get you through everything, because no one is going to just hand you what you want on a silver platter. You have to fight for it. 100%.
If you want to continue the conversation, share your thoughts, or suggest topics for future episodes, be sure to connect with us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and LinkedIn at PlanCo, or visit planco.com.
We hope you've enjoyed today's episode, and until next time, keep playing, keep designing, and keep pushing the boundaries of what's next. This is Play In Conversations, signing off.